Oh, good morning. This is supposed to be the Wooden Spoons program, but we are having some difficulties in terms of our technician wasn't able to come today, and I'm expecting a guest, and we don't know where she is. Maybe she's lost in the university. So in the meantime, I believe we're going to be having some, what did you call that, Kathy?
The robot. We're going to put on a past show.
The robot. And there will be some kind of program offered in lieu of the regular Wooden Spoons program. Our guest today was Janine Gibson, and I was looking forward to talking to her, but I think things... Maybe she couldn't find parking. Maybe she doesn't know how to get here, although I thought I explained it. Or, but thank you, our listeners, for bearing with us. And we'll be back to normal. So thank you, Kathy, for your assistance.
Listening to A Best of Wooden Spoons with Mary Jane Eason and her co-host. As Mary Jane and some others are away, these are being played during the Fridays of August. Please stay tuned for when Mary Jane returns to the station for more live and studio programming in September. This is Jillian Cooper. Thank you. Good morning and welcome to Wooden Spoons. I am Julian Cooper, sitting in for co-host Ryan Wall this morning, and I am with Mary Jane Eason, your local nutritionist. It is the 20th of May, 2016. Good morning, Mary Jane.
Well, good morning, Julian. Thanks for sitting in for Ryan again. And
we have a guest today, is Jermaine. Can you tell me a little more about him?
Okay. Before we get to that, I just want to say that during this show, we're going to be talking about a number of things. One of them later on is about the meeting with the ministers of the it's the Minister of the Environment with Tony Mitra and the results of that meeting over the issue of glyphosate. And another thing, I want to talk about black wood ticks, if we have time. So those are the... And then the third thing, very importantly, we have some very amazing things to give away. We have to try to encourage people to phone in and get some tickets and books, etc. So, and we have a guest this morning, and his name is Dr. German Avila Sakar, a faculty member of the University of Winnipeg, who works in the biology department in ecology and plant science. Dr. Avila was born in Mexico City near the southwest mountains of the Valley of Mexico, and from an early age he was fascinated by plants and cell biology. A child being interested in cell biology. Consequently, he studied biology at the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de Mexico, and I know I'm not saying that correctly. And but where he appreciated being able to study plants in their natural settings. He spent his first work at a tropical biology station in Chamala region, which is a touristy area, and then became hooked on the tropical forest, which led him to do his doctoral studies in Pennsylvania, after which he spent a few years as a researcher at the University in Mexico that I just mentioned, before coming to Nova Scotia and then to Manitoba. So there's been a lot of traveling here. And today, Dr. Avila devotes his time to family life, teaching ecology, evolution, and botany, and doing research in greenhouses in Winnipeg. This morning, we'll be exploring food security from the perspective of research that is taking a different approach from the usual funded studies. We'll be talking to Dr. German Avila about his work and research and the funding issues faced by researchers today. And I think that there are important questions that will arise as we speak and to our guest about this unique funding approach and study. So,
you are listening to a best-of presentation of Wooden Spoons on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. During the month of August, this and other programs chosen by Mary Jane will be played, hopefully to your listening pleasure. For more past programs from Wooden Spoons, go to ckuw.ca, push the buttons for programs and archives, and go to the last page and down to the bottom of the page to Wooden Spoons.
Welcome to Wooden Spoons.
Thank you very much.
I'm very glad that you're able to come this morning. And, I was intrigued by the fact that you were interested in plants at a very young age. So do you want to talk about that and how that influenced you, or how did you get to be interested in plants?
Sure. A little had to do with hiking, being near mountains, and having the chance to simply... I was fortunate that my parents had a mid-sized yard with a few fruit trees, and so we were able to gather some of the fruits, and I guess that was the first contact with different species of trees, and then hiking, and then I started liking to run, and so I would run into far away from the pavement as far as I could, and so that took me to hiking trails, into the mountains, into nature, and I started liking more and more being around in the forests and away from urban areas.
And here you are in Winnipeg in an urban area.
I am, yes. And it's a smaller city compared to Mexico City, of course, and very different environment. No mountains to see around, but a very new kind of habitat for me, the prairies, right? Whatever is left in Manitoba, which is very little, because we have cultivated most of what was prairie environment, is very different. I had no idea the diversity of plants that you can find in this kind of grassland.
That is very, yeah, for sure. That is very true. And you seem to have been able to adapt to different environments quite readily, even though the call of nature is so deep within you.
Yeah.
Interest in that.
Yeah, in fact, I guess also going to the... I was curious about, as you start watching TV documentaries, I became aware of tropical rainforests. I didn't know that tropical seasonal forest existed, so... when I was offered to work there for my undergraduate thesis, I took the opportunity, and then I loved it. It's a fantastic place. It spends about 7 months of the year dry. Most trees are sticks. That's the first impression you get. Uh-huh. This is dead. If you get there in the dry season, and then it just becomes a jungle, and it's lush and full of animal life everywhere and insects all over the place. And so that also made me aware of how different these environments can be and how rich they are.
Amazing. I didn't even know about that at all, seasonal rainforests. So before we get into your talk about your studies, maybe we could discuss the situation that is facing researchers today. Normally, how do universities get their funding, and how are you getting your funding?
Right. So actually, when I started as a professor in Canada, I was fortunate to get what is called a discovery grant from NSERC. NSERC is the National Science and Engineering Research Council. It's one of the three federal agencies that have different funds that they provide for science, for example, or engineering, in this case, something perhaps more technology, but there's also health related and there's social sciences. And so I got here after having a similar kind of fund or a grant from the equivalent in Mexico, which is called CONACYT. So these are national agencies that fund research, and they part of a large idea, at least at their origins, was to fund what we call basic science that research that does not have a commercial or a commercial product right at the end, right? It's very different from the kind of research that you could do at an industry where you have a product in mind that will be achieved at the end of whatever project you have. So this was to keep basic science going, and there are many. So I would say that most countries have some kind of agency like this. It has been interesting, I guess, in the U.S. that would be the NSF, the National Science Foundation, and so. It has been interesting to see in the last 20 years or so that there has been a shift, almost no matter what country you go to, from supporting basic science to making funds more available for certain things that have to do with commercial products at the end or a particular sector. So, for example, that happened in Mexico where CONACYT gave what they call sectorial funds. So for this sector, so for agriculture, and it has to be related just to agriculture or just to I don't know, something that has to be already very close to engineering. So I was going back to Canada here, I did get a discovery grant. They're usually for 5 years in biology, and it was at the rate of $22,000 a year, which allows you to pay for the materials, and some research is more expensive in that aspect. So, for example, molecular biology, there's a lot of expense in all the chemicals that you use and the specialized equipment. But also, it allows you to support students, graduate students, and undergraduate students who work usually doing their theses. And at the end, what they produce is a thesis, one or several papers that are peer-reviewed and published in journals. And that's our product, the information that is readily available. So without that funding, it's difficult to help support those students, right? You don't hire them. They are not employees per se as in a company, but they depend on scholarships. So if they didn't get a scholarship, or they don't have a family that pays them to mm-hmm. study, then they need that kind of support.
And you're talking, you also, as we discussed earlier, that funding, much of the funding is based on industrial partnerships.
So these days, there is a different set of grants that are mm-hmm. industrial partnerships, and apparently there's greater success rate, and the idea is that you first convince an industry about participating in your research, paying for part of the research, and that is around 60% of what you would need, and then NSERC would put in 40%.
And there's also another ruling that has made it more difficult for certain projects to get funding.
Right. If you have something in mind that will fit what for a particular industry wants, then it's good, right? I mean, you're in luck, and they want that. But if you want to do is study, say, the network of pollinators in a certain family of plants in the tropics, and you can't find a link directly to you will produce larger quantities of, I don't know, some kind of mm-hmm. sauce, then mm-hmm. they are not interested, right?
It's like the commercialization of research, what's happening. That has its certain downsides.
It does. Danger signals,
red flags.
Well, it limits, in a way, what you can study, right? Because if you can't show that there's a product that can be mm-hmm. obtained pretty immediately after the mm-hmm. end of your research project, then you're not going to get that.
And then there's the other issue too, that now there is a ruling, I guess, about the universities that are more successful at getting grants.
Right.
So are larger universities.
Yeah, indeed. It's interesting because I've been talking to you and other people more on what I have been gathering without the hard data, but I did bring the stats from the last competition, the 2015 Discovery Grants competition, and they divided by early career researchers, established researchers who are renewing, and established researchers not holding a grant. And you can right away see for any of these categories except the established researchers, where the drop is not so high, there's a drop from large to especially large, medium to small universities. The University of Winnipeg is a small, primarily undergraduate university, even though it has several graduate programs. But So, say, for example, for early career researchers, they are at 67% success in large, 79, if I can read correctly here, percent in medium, and then small is 47% success rate for a discovery grant. For somebody like me, for example, as an established researcher not holding a grant, it is success rates are lower in general, 44% at large, 32% at medium, and 24% at small universities. So that was the trend that started around 2008 or slightly before that, where more funds were allocated to fewer labs in larger universities. And yes, you that doesn't mean that you can't get a grant if you're in a small university. And in fact, we still have a few professors in biology who hold grants. But during my since I started here in 2008, I've seen at least four of my colleagues lose their NSERC funding. And that is that
very
worry.
Troubling.
That worry, yeah,
yep,
struggling.
Very troubling, yep. We're listening to CKOW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, and we're talking to Dr. Jim Germain Avila Sakhar. So you are getting a new source of funding and a new way of doing it. So do you want to describe that?
Sure. So you look for different sources, and some people have approached industry directly. I know some colleagues that have approached Hydro, Manitoba Hydro, and so I thought, who else? There are several sources, and one of them was the University of Winnipeg Foundation. They have, it's not that old, but they started a program called a crowdfunder.
You are listening to the best of Wooden Spoons, chosen by Mary Jane Eason for CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
And so that allows you to raise money for your research. You describe what your research is and try to appeal to the general public. Anyone that has access to a computer and can see a website and watch a brief video about what you plan to do and what the benefits of what you're doing can be for anyone, right? For whether it's a reduced number of people or a larger number of people. And then we depend on donors for that, right? So it is a donation that would be, you would get a tax receipt for that, and then so the person may get a deduction from their.
It's sort of bringing the funding to the public interest.
Well, it is more directly to the public interest in if you get funds from the federal agencies, you're still getting it from the public, right? All the taxpayers'
money, right?
Yes, because
of the taxes,
right?
Yes.
But this is more directly to appealing to the people that mm-hmm. that might directly look at your research.
Yes, yeah. Whereas the taxpayers are paying NSERC, but NSERC is taxpayers are supporting the bigger universities by the sounds of it in that way. Anyway, we'll have to get to talking about your research now, because this this shows a lot of struggle and challenge behind the scenes with getting funding, and people should be aware of that, I think, or somehow this is not a healthy situation. But the research you are doing, you're doing it with tomatoes, and do you want to talk about that and the rationale behind the kind of research you're doing?
Sure. So not too long ago, I met some colleagues from Chile that brought to my attention that there is a big problem with tomato production because any agricultural operation will have the problem of pests, because we have large monocultures where we have lots of plants of the same species. So when an insect that likes and can grow on those plants gets there, their populations become very large. So getting pests on crops is nothing new, but in for tomatoes, it has been particularly severe. There have been outside, so farmers that grow tomatoes in their fields that have decided to stop growing because keeping the pests off the plants is just too much for and the gain is too little. One of the most detrimental pests is a very small insect called the whitefly. It's really a moth, but it's so tiny and it's white, so people call it whitefly. There are many species of this kind of whitefly. There are about 1,500, but two main species that are extremely that cause most of the problems. And the main problems, so these are suckers. They pierce through the stems and leaves, and they suck the sap that is already rich in sugars and amino acids. So that weakens the plants. They are also excreting, and so they produce a film that is organically very good for the growth of fungus. And so then fruits get fungus on top of them, and you can still sell those fruit, the tomato, but you have to clean them. So that would add a cost to the production, because now you have to hire people that clean the fruits. And perhaps the worst part is that they fly around, and as they pierce different plants, they start transmitting viruses. So they are important vectors of plant diseases. And what ends up killing many plants and destroying whole fields are the viruses.
I just have to say, being my small efforts at growing tomatoes have never seen the whitefly, and growing up on the farm, we had tomatoes just for the winter, like we used to do preserving. Never seen a whitefly, never had a problem.
Right. So if you go further away from the equator, these insects become less and less successful. But although you find them in smaller numbers in the fields, they become much more of a problem inside greenhouses, where they have the conditions throughout the year. So if you don't have the correct protocols and a good greenhouse, you're going to be struggling against whiteflies. Happily, lots of producers in Canada seem to have found there are natural enemies of these whiteflies that can be used to control the populations without application of pesticides. But in fields and where you don't have a good greenhouse, farmers end up using pesticides to bring down the populations. They're not very effective because the whiteflies are under the leaves most of the time, not on top. Mm-hmm. And so it's difficult to spray something and then get the contact pesticide to get to the insects.
So the plants in the greenhouse are more susceptible because of the conditions there. But people aren't growing greenhouse plants, are they? Or is that's a source of our tomatoes is from greenhouses rather than farmers' fields?
A lot.
That's interesting.
And more and more and more, yes.
So I could see that could be a big problem in there.
Yes. I think the largest greenhouse operations are in Ontario in Canada. And Canada is maybe not one of the largest producers of tomato worldwide. It's maybe among the first 10. I can't remember exactly. But for example, Chile, India, and China are the top three, and so they are having a huge problem.
No kidding. So you're doing a study to address that. So what is that all about?
So part of the idea comes from, we also use fertilizers to improve our productions, and that fertilizers usually have nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium among as the main ingredients, and then a few micronutrients. Nitrogen is very important. It makes the plants grow, and it's it's also not usually very available in soils. It gets depleted easily. So, but also, if you have healthy plants that have a lot of nitrogen content, well, the herbivores in general love them. They prefer those to plants that do not grow with nitrogen. So by making our plants grow very well, right, and have a lot of nitrogen, they become more attractive to the to pests in general, and to a whitefly. There are quite a few. There's documentation on that also. There's reports of them preferring these plants, and so the idea of this project is to reduce the number of or the amount of nitrogen that we add for fertilization of the soil, and even if the plants perhaps don't grow as we would expect them to grow super profusely, perhaps they would attract fewer insects and therefore still produce better tomatoes and more tomatoes than if you have to if you're applying fertilization. At the same time, if you reduce the need to apply pesticides, if you have fewer pests on your plants, then you're saving some money. Not only well, who cares about the health, right? I mean, I'm just being a bit facetious here, but so we get used to, well, we have to control things with pesticides. Let's mm-hmm. use the pesticides, right? But so the people that apply pesticides have a health risk. The people that get the tomatoes, right? The people that eat the tomatoes. So mm-hmm. we have a social cost that we have not added to when we buy the tomato, right?
That's
which
very
is paying
true.
For every one of those people that yes. have a health risk.
Yes. And so the relationship here is between reduction of fertilizer, particularly nitrogen, and also the reduction of pesticide use.
That's right. Right. And so here's where I have a master's student and a couple of undergraduate students that are just starting their projects, and they got interested in doing parts of these projects. And that's the idea. Let's show that we can grow tomatoes that are commercially viable, right? So that the farmer can still have a production with less fertilizer. And let's also show that you get fewer of white flies growing on them that they do not prefer. So that would be the idea, is to show that these plants that are grown with less fertilizer become also less preferred by the white flies.
And this certainly is against mainstream agriculture, the way they have been approaching it. Totally different.
Well, right, and I suppose there's this economic part that I'm very curious about it. I'm not an economist, but people have devoted some time to also calculating which one is better, right? But I think it's important to get those costs into the calculations and say, well, we're spending so much on pesticides, the application, but we forgot to enter in the social costs and the health risks.
Yeah, so that is the I guess that is the effect your research will be having, like the effect of lower pesticide use and lower nitrogen. How will that affect the ecosystem? You mentioned health effects,
right,
which nobody's ever considered ever,
right.
I don't think.
Well,
not in a study.
We forget easily about those things.
Yes.
So we're making better pesticides. I have to concede our chemists have been working on having pesticides that are degraded by sunlight. They do not last past 24 hours. You are allowed to go back in the field, and your exposure is lower. So the chemicals are breaking down, which is good, but there's always something that remains. So that will end up in the they're soluble most of the time in water, so it goes to our streams and lakes. Maybe in lower concentrations, that's good, but they're still there. And the other part is the fertilizers. When we apply too much fertilizer, then part of that is not taken by the plants. And that also goes to our waterways, ends up in streams and lakes and oceans. And when you have a lot of nitrogen and potassium in those water bodies, you will have zones where you have algal blooms. And when you have algal blooms, then you have lots of other, I like to call them people, other people that eat the algae. So the algae, so zooplankton in general, yes. Right? So the
other beings.
Other beings.
That's lovely.
And so, but unfortunately, those beings do not produce oxygen. They are taking oxygen. Mm-hmm. And so it produces dead zones in these areas.
Yes.
And there are some, if you look at the mouth of the Mississippi, for example, there's very frequently a dead zone around there. There have been dead zones. There are algal blooms in Lake Winnipeg almost every year.
Which have been related in a study to nitrogen runoff from farms. That it's agriculturally related, for
right.
sure.
So on one side, perhaps we can save some money to the farmers. You don't have to add so much nitrogen. You don't have to pay and for the pesticides. And we are gaining in having fewer problems with our ecosystems, right? And
yes.
not
so
killing everything else.
Your research is not really tied into a product like pesticides or or fertilizers. I can see, you know,
exactly.
that this is science for the public good, right?
Well, yeah. We unless there is a company that sells that, right? well-being.
Yes, yes. Well, yes, if we find a way of quantifying well-being, they certainly will do that. All the free things are the most important, eh? The most important things in life are free. But anyway, well, thank you so much for sharing your study with us. I think it's very exciting, and it's sort of alternative. Very alternative, isn't it?
I hope so. I think so, in part. Sometimes you get so much into it that you don't know. You have thought so much about it that you think,
yes.
oh, this is old.
But it is groundbreaking in the sense that it's signaling a change from this heavy dependence on pesticides and fertilizers. We have to change our ways, and you know.
Right. I hope so. Yeah.
Yes, it's a hard, big challenge.
Yes. Yes. And well, thank you for helping me share these and
yes, and we'll have to follow up on your study when is a good time to talk about the results. Come back?
Sure. For sure in a year, because
okay.
we have to, my master's student by the name, I should say their names, Sridevi Ramachandran, she's the leader of this study, and Dane Mimko and Ian Alexander are all involved in part of this research. And so I thank them very much because they put in a lot of time and effort, and they study very hard to get this done.
Well, maybe they could all come together and share the thesis with you.
Yes, yes, that'd be great.
Thank you so much. And I think you suggested a song. And do you want to tell us about that?
Sure. So I thought tomatoes. Well, let's see what's about tomatoes. And I found this Oliver Schreier and the Stewed Tomatoes, and they have a track called Stewed Tomatoes, and I liked it. So I hope your listeners like this.
All right, we're going to do that. I'm Julian Cooper, and you're listening to Wooden Spoons. And this is Friday morning, May 20th. So thank you for bringing us the song suggestion. We shall play it.
Lots, then crazy little thing right now.
for CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. This is Julian Cooper. You are listening to CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, and this is one of a selection of four Best of Wooden Spoons for the month of August. And we still have Germaine with us. Hermine. More like Hermine, right?
Hermine.
And I'd like you to put a message over the station on how you know us, how you know the station. What are you doing?
Sure. I actually came here first for an interview with, I guess first it was with People of Interest, with Michael Welch. And then it was Jordan.
Poitras, I believe.
Poitras, who had a dark science, what was it called?
I can't remember. Dark matter science or something like that.
That's right.
And black coat kind of science.
And so that's how I met the station, and then I started meeting some people here, including Julian. And then I realized I had been dreaming about doing a show for a long time, so I thought maybe I would propose it, and that is Cafecito Latinoamericano.
And you've been on, what, about a year now?
About a year. I can't remember the exact date, but yeah, it was May last year that we started.
All right. I wanted to make sure that got out because he is one of our members, and we like to do the show promos, and that is our show promo for today.
That's right. Cafecito Latinoamericano will be on Fridays 11 to 12.
Is it a music show or a spoken word?
It's a combination. It's about half music, half spoken word, a few news, and now and then interviews. We had Gabrielle Fields from Mariachi Ghost last week, so...
Great.
Well,
well done.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Now we're going on to another topic. Should I talk about the black-legged wood tick, Julian, or should I talk about something else?
I say go for the black tick. That could be interesting.
I knew you'd say that. I've got this information from the Manitoba Cooperator from May 2016. Personally, I have never encountered a black-legged tick. I certainly have had wood ticks. I'm known to have wood ticks on me occasionally, but grew up on the farm, never seemed to have a problem with ticks at all. And then of late, it seems that there are these different diseases, and I wished our doctor Germaine was here because I had a question for him about the emergence of all these different diseases happening, and makes me think that there's a toxicity in nature. But anyways, we heard that the black-legged wood tick is responsible for Lyme disease, and May is Lyme Disease Awareness Month, and the Manitoba Health Seniors and Active Living is reminding Manitobans that wood tick and that tick-borne diseases are preventable. So you have to do checks on yourself to see if you have them on you whenever you go outdoors in the country, and also knowing where you can expect to see the black-legged ticks is a good idea, so you can avoid that. Recognizing the signs of the symptoms. And also, I guess, the right clothing, wearing protective clothing or tick repellent is very helpful. And keeping on the path, do not go inside the forest. Do not go inside amongst the... Stay on your path, human beings. Stay right on your path and don't go into the bushes.
I actually portaged on a canoe trip, so that was pretty interesting. We had tick problems, too.
Who did? You were talking and you were not on air.
I think I actually was, but anyways, I was... doing a portage on a canoe trip, and we had tick problems, and so we had to wear decent clothing that was going to cover certain parts to make sure you're okay, and check each other, whatever.
Yeah, we found some ticks.
And dogs get ticks a lot, too. And I noticed Lee Valley's store actually has a tick remover. And so it'll be easy to remove ticks, a little gadget. Imagine.
Yeah, and you can also use various other methods. People have suggestions with tweezers and various things, but you're not supposed to break the head off in the skin.
And that occasionally happens. I know I've had that happen. Anyway, there's Lyme disease that can be caused by these ticks, and also anaplasmosis and babesiosis. Those are two new diseases, apparently, that are emerging as tick-borne diseases. It makes me wonder why this is happening. And these ticks that commonly cause Lyme disease and anaplasmosis and babesiosis are most commonly found within and along the edge of forests and in areas with thick woody shrubs and other vegetation. And they're found most often from early spring through late fall. So basically the whole season is a tick season. And they're difficult to see. And so apparently the province is monitoring and assessing the continuing range expansion of black-legged ticks and has identified black-legged tick risk areas where the risk of tick-borne disease transmission is greatest. So that is being put on a website too. So the ticks that are found in those risk areas are more likely to carry the agents that cause these diseases, these new diseases, and Lyme disease. And so limiting exposure is the best way to go. And here are some of the suggestions to minimize exposure and risk. Applying an appropriate tick repellent, following label directions on exposed skin and clothing. Inspecting yourself and the children and pets after spending time outdoors. Removing ticks as soon as possible from people and pets. Staying to the center of the walking trails. Wearing long pants and long sleeve shirts, and keeping grass and shrubs around homes cut short so that to create drier environments that are less suitable for black-legged tick survival. So the symptoms, of course, can start 5 to 21 days after a tick bite and may include fever, chills, headache, joint aches, nausea, and vomiting, often in association with blood abnormalities and or liver abnormalities. And anaplasmosis can be successfully treated with antibiotics. And the same thing with the other disease, babesiosis, can start from 1 to 6 weeks after tick bite and may include nonspecific flu-like symptoms such as fever, chills, sweats, headache, body aches, and all those fun things. And also can be treated by antibiotics.
And lasting problems, too, apparently, if it's not treated right away or something like that. So you got to be concerned about that because it can live with you for a while.
And then symptoms of Lyme disease can start about 3 days to 1 month after tick bite, often with an expanding rash, which then fades.
You would want to consult your doctor to be sure on what's going on. If you have a concern or if you don't feel well, we are not doctors here, but we would just encourage you to watch for bloodborne animals, or insects, pardon me.
So, well, ticks are animals too.
Yeah, they are. Effectively, they are.
Although they have many legs.
And watch for the bears as well, because they might be.
And then, if you think you have anaplasmosis or babesiosis or Lyme disease, you should see your doctor. And for more information, you can contact HealthLinks at 204-788-8200. Or the toll-free number at 1-888-315-9257. And there is a blog. There is a website that you can go to for information showing the high-risk areas. www.government.mb.ca/health/public-health/cdc/tickborne/index.html. I personally don't get concerned about these things, but I'm just mentioning this in case. Just to be aware.
This is from the, the source of this is Manitoba Cooperator, correct?
Yes.
Great, thanks.
Farm magazine, farm newspaper. So that should put the scare into everybody if they from going in the outdoors, but that's not the intention. I think we have to be aware of the dangers, but also be respectful of nature. And my personal concern is, I think nature becomes toxic when we aren't respecting it. So we need to have a new consciousness of care and respect for the earth and for all creation.
What's your recipe?
Okay. I have a recipe for carrot and parsnip salad, and I have to admit it was borrowed from the Winnipeg Free Press, but I tried it and I thought it was pretty good. So it's interesting because parsnip is not a very common vegetable, or it is not that commonly used, and it is quite expensive. So I think people use it sparingly. Some people use it in soups with chicken. When they make chicken soup, they add parsnip and carrot to the soup. You can make a parsnip soup by itself, and you can bake parsnips by itself or in combination with other vegetables. It has a very sweet taste and a very unique taste. You can even fry it. Have you ever eaten parsnips, Julian? I want to put you on the spot here before I give you the recipe.
I have. I'm sorry. I didn't quite enjoy them, but I have had them.
Okay. You would.
They're
you
healthy.
Would say that. Okay.
Being honest.
Okay. And the texture is a little different than carrots. So anyways, here is the recipe. It calls for 1/3 cup of milk and 1/3 cup of parsley, finely chopped. 2 tablespoons of mayonnaise, and if you're vegan, you can use veganaise. 1 tablespoon of Dijon mustard, and I used another type of mustard I had, homemade. 3/4 teaspoon of salt, 1/2 teaspoon of dried tarragon, 1/4 teaspoon of black pepper, 2 carrots cut into julienne strips. That's a tedious job, and if you have a mandolin, or certain attachments on your food processor, that would help a lot. The strips should be very thin to be julienne. 2 parsnips cut into julienne strips, and 1 tart apple cored and diced. So if you can get a green apple, and often they're covered with a coating of paraffin or petroleum products, so I think it's good to take the peel off. So in a large serving bowl, you whisk together the milk, parsley, lemon juice, mayonnaise, mustard, salt, tarragon, and pepper. Add the carrots, parsnips, and apple. Toss well to combine. Cover and refrigerate until well chilled. And it's a very nice recipe. We made it in our class at New Directions, and I've served it, and people liked it. I also have a very quick recipe for a blueberry smoothie, which is very tasty. 3 cups of milk and 1/2 cup of coconut milk, 1 banana cut up, and 1.5 cups of fresh or frozen blueberries, wild is preferable, and 1/4 cup of sweeteners such as cane sugar or maple syrup if you like, a sprinkle of lime or lemon juice, and a sprinkle of nutmeg, freshly grated or in powdered form, and 1/2 a teaspoon of vanilla. And so you just put all that in the blender and you blenderize it, and it makes a lovely smoothie.
Mm-hmm. Smoothies can be made for all kinds of things, and that sounds like a good one. And if you ever don't have the stuff to make it, just make sure you have the kind of some basics of this, that, and the other thing that's kind of in the same line, and you can make another kind of smoothie. And they almost taste similar or different depending on how they're made.
Yeah, and the lemon juice, or we didn't even put lime or lemon juice in the ones that we made in our class because...